I'm Evan Kleiman, and this is Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. There are so many autoimmune disorders that plague us, from irritable bowel syndrome to asthma. So what do worms have to do with all of this? You'll be shocked to hear. And wouldn't it be romantic to hike the hundreds of miles on the Pacific Crest Trail with your girlfriend? One man tells the tale of sweat, heavy packs, and hunger. Cupcakes, they just won't go away. How to indulge this type of fetish? But first, let's see what's in season at the area farmers markets this week.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. We're happy today to get a hold of Evan Kleiman, who's here visiting the market like she frequently does. And as always, Evan, you've got something great to cook. And why don't you tell us today what you're planning on making?
Well, I have to tell you that when I first saw Carlsbad Aqua Farms, I didn't know what to think. And then I went and I looked at the product, which are beautiful mussels, clams, oysters, these little calico scallops. They're like a dream. So I bought some of the clams, and they're so fresh, so beautifully taken care of. What I like to do is just a really standard linguine vongole, the Italian way of cooking. You could either just serve it with big chunks of bread in big bowls, or on top of pasta, I just take, as you know, a copious amount of olive oil. You know, it should just completely cover the bottom of the pan. Add as much garlic as you want. And then I like to use a healthy pinch of red pepper flakes. And then I throw in my cleaned clams.
Rinse them?
Soak them. I soak them in water in a bowl. The thing you never want to do is like put them in a sink and then let the water drain, then lift them out. Because what you've done is you've just put all the sand right back into the clams. What you want to do is put them in a bowl or in your sink, move them around a little bit in the cold water, lift them out, put them in the bowl, drain out the water, and do that again like two or three times. So let's go back to the pot. We have garlic, hot pepper, oil in the pot. I throw in the clams, and I like to do it so it's pretty much one layer. And then I add just half a cup to one cup of whatever white or rosé wine I have already opened and available. I like to add a really big handful of Italian parsley that's pretty coarsely chopped. And I put the lid on, turn it up high, agitate it like you used to do with Jiffy Pop. In about 3 minutes, you'll lift the lid up. Most of them will be open. If they're not all open, you'll move the pan around a little bit, put the lid back on. And you want all of them open. You don't want to eat any clams that haven't opened. And then last Sunday when I made them, I got some beautiful Swiss chard. And I love to use the stems separately. So I cut up all the stems and threw those in too. So you get this nice combination of the clams and just a little bit of vegetable. And that's it. Then what you really want to do if you're using spaghetti is you want to lift out all the clams once they're done into a bowl. So then you have this beautiful liquor, this clam liquor infused by all the flavor you put in. And when your pasta is nicely cooked, pretty al dente, you'll put the pasta in that juice and let it just sop it up over low heat for about a minute. Oh my gosh. Then you just put it in bowls, top with the clams. Everybody is extremely happy and they think you're a genius.
That was Evan Kleiman, of course, host of this show and chef owner and inspiration from Angeli Cafe. You can find the Carlsbad Aqua Farm truck at all four Santa Monica markets and also every Sunday at the Hollywood Market. We're visiting now with a new farmer here at the Wednesday Farmers Market. His name is Matt Parker. He is a mushroom grower. His company has a wonderful name. It's called Shiitake Happens. And you are down in Hermosa Beach. You're a local grower. And tell us, Matt, what kind of mushrooms you're growing.
We started off with oyster mushrooms. It's a really resilient first great crop, really strong, really wants to grow. So I start with a mushroom spore. I transfer that to organic rye grain and then transfer that to cereal straw. And I grow them in long columns that hang from the ceiling, and they grow out of plastic bags in large bouquets. It's awesome.
Now, how did you learn how to do this, and where do you get these spores?
You can get the spores from an existing mushroom. You can make a spore print, or you can clone a mushroom, and then you grow it in a petri dish. And I guess the man to blame for all this is Paul Stamets, who's an amazing mycologist.
And you went and introduced yourself and said, I want to grow mushrooms. Tell me how to do it.
He does a seminar, 6 ways that mushrooms can change the world, up in Olympia, Washington.
What kind of a structure or building or space do you have to grow these in?
I grow in a shipping container, believe it or not.
Oh.
So something you see on the back of a big rig truck, I turn it into a grow room, or I refer to it the mushroom.
The mushroom.
Yeah,
okay,
clever.
So it has to be dark. It has to be temperature controlled.
Humidity, temperature, light, airflow, and you can grow mushrooms.
Okay, so the one you have now, you're only growing the oysters?
Oysters, whites, and then I have my pilot run of pinks and golds coming up, so branching out.
Okay, and can describe to us an oyster mushroom, what it looks like, and then what the flavor is.
An oyster mushroom has the white ones have a white, smooth top, and then gills that run from the cap all the way down the stems. And you can eat up to where the gills stop. And as far as flavors, the smaller ones are really nutty, and the larger ones do have a seafood flavor, hence oyster mushrooms.
Oh, I thought it was because they looked like oysters.
Yeah, they're all the same.
I actually cooked some. I took some home last week, and I chopped them up, and I just sauteed them with olive oil and a little bit of onion. Then I added a little bit of butter at the end, and they have a wonderful, wonderful rich flavor.
I love them. They're delicious.
Yeah. And how much are these a pound?
We're looking at $10 a pound for the oysters.
So a pound of mushrooms, that's got to be a lot of mushrooms.
You think so, but yeah. A pound will feed about 4 people.
That was Matt Parker, and he's a brand new mushroom grower. He's learning how to grow mushrooms. He's got nice, beautiful oyster mushrooms right now. He's at the Wednesday Santa Monica Market. Mark your calendars now for Thursday night, August 14th. We're going to be having our next library panel series here in Santa Monica. Our special guest is going to be Sherry Yard, of course, is the James Beard Award-winning pastry chef from Spago, moderated by our very own Evan Kleiman. We're going to be talking with Sherry about the passion of pastry, what it takes to be the best pastry chef in America. So join us. It's a free program from 7 till 9 p.m., Santa Monica Main Library. Hope to see you there. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
If you'd like to get a more detailed view of the linguine with vongole that I talk about with Laura Avery, check out our blog. I have a detailed photo essay of me making it. 2 weeks ago, I talked about the Mexican popsicle or paleta. A listener wrote in to tell us about Mateo's Paletas. They have 3 locations in L.A. She recommends the leche quemada, or toasted milk flavor. Go to the blog at kcrw.com/goodfood to get the locations. Hiking, doesn't it sound idyllic? There's nature, quiet, getting away from modern life. A hiking trip sounds like the perfect thing to take your girlfriend on. Dan White did just that. He decided to tackle the Pacific Crest Trail, a 2,600-mile trail that runs from Mexico to Washington. How two people who've never shared an apartment survived 6 months in the wild in a 2-man pup tent with little more than trail mix. That's next on Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. Sounds so romantic. A young couple leaves their lives behind to hike the Pacific Crest Trail. As it turns out, it's not all bed of roses. And just what do you eat up there day after day walking the dusty or snow-covered trail? Dan White has written a pretty funny book called The Cactus Eaters about his trek with his girlfriend. He's here to tell us about his food adventures on the Pacific Crest Trail. Hi, Dan.
Hi, great to be here.
So what is the Pacific Crest Trail?
The Pacific Crest Trail goes from Mexico to Canada. It traverses all of California, all of Oregon, all of Washington, 2,650 miles long, through deserts, some really icy mountain passes. You see a bit of everything when you're out there.
And is it sort of the thing to do to hike its entirety? Do many people do that?
Many people try to do it. People also break it up into sections. They call themselves end-to-enders, and they'll do a little bit of it every year until they finish it eventually. And a thru-hiker is a person who does one sustained walk over the entire thing, usually in a 5 to 6 month period.
And how long did it take you?
Not 5 or 6 months. I was telling someone the other day, it's pretty great that I'm not still on there. Everything that we did, it went a little bit screwy, a little haywire. So it was quite a thing.
I would imagine that food assumes a monumental importance when you're doing such a trek. First of all, when you get to stop and you get to eat.
When you stop and eat, it's a moment of pure joy, but it depends on what's in your rucksack, right? Because if people are like me, they'll eat the yummy stuff first. And then by the time you're getting closer to town, you have just the yuckiest, most disgusting stuff. We had this stuff called sweet and sour supper. How do I describe it? It was freeze-dried, floating globs of, I think, seitan or protein, and with a kind of a pineapple-y, kind of lemony, yucky stuff. And it was really sad.
You said the words, when you get to town. How long was it in between your ability to replenish yourselves with food?
Well, often you're out for about a week, and the legs, the divisions of the trail, about 25 segments. So you're talking, you know, roughly 100 miles each on average. And for the most part, you're way out there, and you've got to hitchhike into the town. And I would go nuts with the food in town. I would eat everything. I would eat multiple cheeseburgers. I ate an entire blackberry pie once.
Are there camping gear stores where you get your food, or did you have to send food? How did you get your food?
What you do is you send a big old box of food to yourself, general delivery. And it's got to be shelf stable because it's the stuff that has to keep. So you get your dried food, your freeze-dried food, all that other stuff. You get to the town, you go to the post office, and you slice open the box with your Swiss Army knife and stuff all the stuff into your rucksack. But what you get to do is you get to complement some of those foods by going out there and getting your string cheese. I find that stuff keeps because they lock that stuff in tight. Nothing gets in or out of that. I can eat string cheese 3 days in, and I've never gotten deathly ill because of that. Fresh fruit for maybe the first couple of days. Every once in a while, I'll bring a little tin of oysters or something just to supplement the calories and dump it in your mac and cheese, stuff like that. So
how many calories do you burn a day?
That's the scary part. You burn about 6,000 calories a day.
Oh, maybe I should do this as a,
what's crazy,
as a diet program.
Because you're just completely just funneling food into your mouth all of the time, and you still feel like you're atrophying. That's especially true in the High Sierra because you want to carry less pack weight, meaning that you're more reliant on the kind of dehydrated foodstuffs, but you're needing more and more calories. And that's tough. It's hard to beat that ratio of weight versus sustenance.
Now, you say that you were known as the junk food couple.
That's right. Part of my attempt to beat that calorie curve, I would bring just gigantic, econo-sized lumps of sugar and goo. I was obsessed with gummy bear kinds of things, gummy jellies. And sometimes in the desert, they would kind of melt into a big, kind of a translucent steak of gummy bears. But I would eat any junk food. And we would sometimes aim for the bittersweet chocolate because it has got a slightly higher melting point. What you don't want to see happen is to open up your rucksack and find it just covered with goo.
Did you end up licking off your extra shoes?
Oh,
sucking
yeah.
on socks?
Whatever you got out there that's covered with chocolate, you stick it in your mouth. It doesn't matter what it is.
Now, what were some of your favorite meals?
Adding oysters to anything for some reason
makes it better. No, you mean smoked oysters,
I'm
right?
I'm so sorry. Smoked oysters. But what you got to do, you get the Annie's organic white cheddar stuff, and then I would dump a lot of dehydrated milk powder in there, mix it all up, even take a little margarine. They have these little airtight margarine packs. Stir it all up, and then I would dump the entire oyster stuff, including the green viscous goo, and just stir it up. It probably sounds vile to people listening, but it's so good when you're hungry.
And cheese with smoked oysters.
Mac and cheese. And there's one more thing which people should think about too, and that is instant chocolate mousse.
Did you end up foraging for any food?
What I did do in the Cascades is eat the really obvious stuff. Huckleberries are something that everybody on earth should try. It. Think of a super-sized, super fragrant blueberry. Just amazing. Thimbleberries, which is like a stripped down, real thin, but really nice tasting raspberry. They had gooseberries, which were covered with horrible spines, but a really nice, kind of a kiwi tasting thing. And then sometimes we'd eat the wild garlic, stick that in the mac and cheese too.
Did you have any just total food debacles?
I had a Thanksgiving dinner that was an absolute total debacle. That was in the desert. And for Thanksgiving, I had dehydrated Sosnick matzo balls. How do you dehydrate a matzo ball? I am Jewish, and so I guess I had a sort of a went into kind of
they
a seizure of meat.
They make dehydrated matzo balls?
Yeah, it's with actually a rather flavorful broth, but it's kind of like a Nerf ball kind of a thing.
And when it was all over and you booked yourself into a hotel and you got totally clean, what was the first, like, total real meal that you ate?
I hate to say it, but it was a microwave burrito. And you eat crazily for a long while after the PCT. I became a very large person for a while. So what you have to realize is you kind of have to sort of rest yourself away from your eating habits on the trail.
Fascinating. Thank you, Dan.
Oh, you're very welcome.
The Cactus Eaters is Dan White's funny account of his journey. Go to kcrw.com/goodfood to learn more about both the Pacific Crest Trail and Dan. One thing people fear about eating in the wild is the dreaded intestinal worm. Over the last few decades, the U.S. has done a great job of cleaning up the food supply, so there aren't so many of these worms hanging around. But some researchers are noticing a corresponding rise in autoimmune disorders like irritable bowel syndrome and asthma. Could there be a link? More on this when Good Food continues on KCRW and KCRW.com. What is going on with all this prevalence of food allergies everywhere? There's gluten-free, sugar-free, peanut-free, soy-free, dairy-free diets. It's everywhere. But why? Dr. Joel Weinstock is with us today to talk about the surge in allergies and autoimmune disorders. He suggests that the answer just might be, are you ready? Worms. Hi there, doctor.
Hello.
Is there really a huge surge in allergies, or does it just seem that way to most of us folks?
Well, my greatest expertise is in inflammatory bowel diseases, but my allergy friends tell me that allergic diseases of various types, such as food allergy, asthma, and similar type ailments, have increased substantially.
Why?
Well, nobody has proven for sure, but one of the leading hypotheses is the hygiene hypothesis.
And could you explain what that is?
Well, basically, when children are born, we all have an immune system. That immune system has to be programmed between the ages of 0 or 12. It's really kind of a blank slate. And the programming that develops our immune system is the exposures we have as children. The immune system has two major parts. There's a part that is the fight response that kills off the evil bacteria and viruses that get in us and keeps us well. And then there's another aspect of the immune system, which we call regulation, which controls and limits those responses so they don't do any harm. So basically, what people think may be happening is that due to our very clean environments, that lack of exposures to certain organisms is resulting in abnormal development of this immune programming, leaving us susceptible to the various immunological diseases as we get older.
I understand that for some of the diseases that you deal with in your patients, instead of starting to look at what causes the diseases, you looked to the past to see what was preventing them?
Well, one of the problems we've had over the last 20 or so years is when people try to look for the causes of various diseases, nothing really stands out as the cause. That is, in terms of food dyes and vaccinations and things that we're exposed to that are new. So a number of years ago, we decided to look at the problem a little differently. We said, well, maybe it isn't a result of something new that people are being exposed to. Could it be the result of lack of exposure to something that we've always been exposed to. But in the latter part of the 20th century, we've eliminated that exposure. In other words, an exposure that was protective rather than causative.
And what did you find?
Well, at least with inflammatory bowel disease, and I think also with other immunological diseases, that people who live in very clean, industrialized societies tend to get these diseases, and people who live in less developed, less clean societies don't, or they get it at a much lower level. And one of the factors that seems to be related is deworming of the population.
So when you say deworming of the population, most of us don't take any pills for deworming. It's something that's just occurred naturally by our lack of exposure to the ground, to dirt?
That is correct. Certain types of parasites, the types we're talking about are called helminths. They're worm-like critters, and they're animals. And prior to the 20th century, everybody had some of these animals within their GI tract or elsewhere. Now, how does a helminth potentially protect us? Well, we've learned over the last few years that helminths induce regulator cells. So when a helminth gets into the body, let's say into the gut, these creatures have learned to, over many thousands of years of evolution, to limit our immune responses. Otherwise, they wouldn't be able to live within us. And this limitation involves suppressing or dampening hyperreactive immune responses through the induction of regulator cells.
So tell me about some of the research you've done, or actually the treatment that you've done with some patients who have been suffering a lot with very uncomfortable symptoms.
Well, a few years back, we got permission to give people a helminth to see if it could change their disease. The diseases we were studying were Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis, which are chronic inflammatory conditions of the gut. And the helminth we chose was a pig whipworm, a worm that pigs get but can also colonize people. We gave people these helminth eggs, and their disease got better.
Now, for the individual that was actually participating in this study, were they basically at their wits' end with their symptoms that they were willing to overcome our natural sort of distaste for the idea of worms?
Well, you know, when people are getting steroids, when people are on immune suppressive drugs that can cause lymphoma, they're much more afraid of modern-day medications than they are of helminth eggs. In very few patients, the ick factor was not a huge problem. The eggs that we give people, if you took 2,000 eggs and you put it on the head of a pin, you could barely see it at all.
So how do we get back in balance? I would imagine the best answer isn't just to go out and eat some dirt.
What I usually say when people ask me what we should do, I look at what children used to do before the latter part of the 20th century. So my advice would be, let your kids play in the dirt. They don't have to wash their hands constantly. And get two dogs and a cat. And don't deworm the animals. And we'll make the kids real happy, and perhaps we'll make them healthier.
Dr. Joel Weinstock is director of the Center for Inflammatory Bowel Disease at Tufts Medical Center. There's a few really interesting articles about this subject at kcrw.com/goodfood. Some people say that food allergies may be a result of an overactive immune system. More people than ever are aware of food allergies. Walk into any school and you'll see peanut-free zone signs everywhere. So how do we live with them? Some ideas next on Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. Food allergies. I have to tell you that if you're a chef, it seems like one out of three people among us can't eat something. To help us understand what's going on, Dr. Michael Wilkes is here. Dr. Wilkes is a leader with an international reputation for innovation in medical education. Currently, he serves as professor of medicine and vice dean for medical education at UC Davis. And just as an aside, he also has a little segment here on KCRW called Second Opinion on Sunday mornings. What are the most common food allergies?
Well, I think that to begin with, there are lots of people that have problems with food, and we have to be careful because most of them don't have food allergies. A technical definition of allergies involves the human body's immune response to a foreign protein called an allergen. The body produces an antibody called IgE. Now, your question was, what are the most common allergies? And I'll tell you in a second, but it is to say that there are a lot more foods that cause problems but aren't causing them through the allergic mechanism. So to answer your question, the most common allergies are milk and eggs, nuts, perhaps gluten, wheat, and soy.
So does that include sensitivities? Should we call them sensitivities as opposed to allergies?
Well, sure. You're on the west side of Los Angeles, and sensitivities are always a good thing to talk about. It's always good to be sensitive. And certainly most of the problems that people have with food perhaps would fall into the category of sensitivities. Again, I'm not sure if you can use the G word on radio, but foods that produce lots of gas aren't necessarily sensitivities. That's just the way the body and the bacteria that live within our body react.
An allergy would be somebody going into anaphylactic shock, for example.
Absolutely. That would be an example. The most common manifestation of a food allergy would be either the skin, a rash and itching and that kind of thing, or in the GI system, cramping, diarrhea, nauseousness, etc. And then at one extreme, affecting a very small number of people, but in a very serious way, are the anaphylactic reactions, the narrowing of the breathing tube so that air can no longer pass through it, and at its extreme, death. Not a good thing.
No, not a good thing. Now, how does one go about diagnosing a food allergy?
In clinical practice, most of this can be done in a low-tech way, using two strategies. One is what's called the elimination diet, and on the other side is the food challenge test. The elimination diet is you begin to look for patterns in your eating behavior or your child's eating behavior and try to identify, you know, two or three major culprits. And most of us can do this pretty well in our life. And then you go whole hog. You get rid of all of that ingredient in your diet. So if it's milk or eggs or whatever, and you go that way for a week or two or three, and then you begin to slowly add things back and you pay attention. I actually have my patients use a log and we look at it together. And then they also keep track of their intestinal complaints or skin complaints or whatever they're having until we can identify something. Then we have them go without it for a period of time a second time. And then we add that thing back in. And if they truly are allergic, you should be able to identify it quickly.
And once you've identified something that is truly an allergy, what is the best treatment? Total avoidance?
Well, I mean, it depends on what it is that you're allergic to. Clearly, the best treatment is to avoid the food. Now, you know, that is easier said than done. You know, clearly, if you're allergic to eggs, you can not use eggs. But when you go out to the restaurant, and you can look at the menu and, you know, sometimes you can identify if there are eggs in something and sometimes you can ask the waiter for help. But many times the waiter doesn't have any idea how the chef is cooking these things. And, you know, if you get a little bit of gas or a little bit of skin itching, you know, it may not be the worst thing if you make a mistake. If, on the other hand, you have a profound nut allergy, you just are going to have to be very careful. And, you know, sending kids to summer camp, sending them to school, particularly when they're young enough that they can't be educated, you know, is a scary venture.
It's been really a wonderful conversation. Thank you very much.
Well, you're most welcome.
Dr. Michael Wilkes is professor of medicine and vice dean for medical education at UC Davis. He's also on KCRW each Sunday morning with his commentary on the medical field. It's called A Second Opinion. It's always provocative and can be podcast each week. Go to kcrw.com/goodfood for more details. All this talk of things you can't eat makes me really ready for something scrumptious and delicious and moist, like a cupcake. Do you suffer from a cupcake fetish? I can help. A place to turn for up-to-the-minute cupcake reviews and a Google map to locate the nearest cupcakery. It's here when Good Food returns on KCRW and KCRW.com. For some of us, traveling cross-country or maybe even to another country might involve seeking out the best regional dish. Maybe it's barbecue, maybe it's apple pie, maybe it's cupcakes. You might have noticed that cupcake mania is here to stay. And one way to know it's really here to stay is by the website cupcakefetish.com. My guest, Violet Whips, an alias, by the way, documents cupcakes and that mania on cupcakefetish.com. Now share with us this cross-country cupcake crawl that you did.
Yeah. So one of my reviewers, Baron, was living in Los Angeles and moved to Pittsburgh. And in the process of his move, had to drive all of his possessions from Los Angeles to Pittsburgh. And I said, here's a crazy idea. Why don't I fly out to L.A. and help you drive across the country, but why don't we stop at as many cupcake places as we can across the way? And, you know, we just decided to do it and see how it would go. And it turned out to be a lot of fun, though. For both of us, we had to have a moratorium on the cupcake consumption at the end and kind of hold off for a month or so before we could eat cupcakes again.
Oh, did you have a daily limit?
We had all these rules that we thought would be a good idea, and then we ended up not sticking to any of them. And so, you know, originally we thought, oh, well, we'll only get 2 cupcakes from each place we visit so we don't get too overloaded. And we ultimately ended up visiting 32 cupcake places and eating 56 cupcakes in about a week. So
I thought you were going to tell me a month.
No, it was about 7 days. So we didn't stick to our limit at all.
So what do you tend to enjoy? Do you like really sweet cupcakes, or do you like them to be a little sort of less sweet and more complex in flavor? Do you like really traditional flavors?
I'm a fan of traditional. My all-time favorite flavor is still vanilla cake with chocolate frosting. But I do really appreciate when cupcakeries get creative.
What were like the biggest hits on that trip?
There was a cupcake called the Blueberry Morning from Cake Nouveau in Ann Arbor, Michigan. And it was really good. It was almost like a take on the blueberry muffin, but in cupcake form. So the cake was really delicate, and it was sweet. And the frosting was light and fluffy and not overly sweet. And it was just this really refreshing cupcake. And then, you know, on the more traditional side, I had a chocolate frosting vanilla cake cupcake from a cupcakery called The Cupcakery in Las Vegas. And they just did that classic combination really well. The cake was really nice and moist, and the frosting was really rich and thick and fudgy.
What did you think of Los Angeles cupcakes?
I've tried cupcakes from lots of large cities, Los Angeles, Chicago, New York, Seattle. And in general, I find that it's really the hole-in-the-wall places, the places you haven't heard of in the small cities, like the Pink Moon Cupcake Bakery in Powell, Ohio, just has amazing cupcakes. And you think, Powell, Ohio, that's not somewhere where you would expect to find top-notch cupcakes, and yet there they are.
I'm so disappointed that we didn't entertain you out here with our cupcakes.
So in Los Angeles, I've had some good cupcakes. Probably the best ones I've had in LA were from Dots in Pasadena. But in general, I found cupcakes in Los Angeles to be a little too sweet for me. I think LA folk have sweet tooth. Yeah. And even the ones at Dots were slightly too sweet for me, but their strawberry shortcake was just amazing.
So what is your all-time favorite cupcake that you just, even after you're all cupcaked out, you think to yourself at about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, boy, I really wish I had a blank from blank right now.
The vegan blacktop cupcake from Coco's Cupcake Cafe in Pyrn, Pittsburgh. And I'm not just saying this.
Okay, I'm just
Pittsburgh.
About to completely so change my whole frame of reference with you. How could a vegan cupcake be your, like, Jonesy thing?
It's just the most amazing cupcake I've ever had. And, you know, it goes back to me really enjoying that vanilla cake with the chocolate frosting combo. It's just my favorite combination of flavors. And this is like the gourmet version of vanilla with chocolate frosting. And it's vegan. And you would never know that from eating it, which is crazy. They just do this amazing vanilla cake with really dark cocoa powder that's swirled into the batter. And it's topped with a vegan chocolate frosting and then a dollop of really dark chocolate ganache on top of that. And it's probably hands down the most phenomenal cupcake I've ever had.
That was Violet Whips, an alias. She is the main reviewer at CupcakeFetish.com. We will have a link to them at our website, kcrw.com/goodfood. You can easily develop a fetish for something like cupcakes. But can I, Evan Kleiman, host of this food show, turn a cooking troglodyte into a home cook? Let's see. I'll be back with Good Food producer Bob Carlson to find out what happened with the cooking assignment that I gave him last month. The season finale of Cooking with Bob Carlson up next. That's in 1 minute, right here on Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. Many of you have been following with great interest the cooking career of the production director of KCRW, Bob Carlson. As you may know, he came to me wondering how it would be possible to learn a few new things that would be easy to do that he could do in the kitchen and feel competent, less insecure. So we embarked on this little project. This is the last time we're going to have a conversation for a little while. We're taking a bit of a hiatus, but Bob, I hear that you had success with your last assignment.
I know. I think this is going to come as a great disappointment to a lot of people who have been listening to these segments who like to laugh at my misfortune and my difficulties in cooking. And we've had some emails where, you know, people felt sorry for me, and, you know, which wasn't exactly the idea. But I think that you can call this chicken curry dish that you assigned me last a complete success.
I cannot be happier. I'm thrilled. And I understand that it's been made again.
Oh, yeah. It's now become part of our regular repertoire.
See, that's perfect. Okay. Yeah. Was it just that the end result was a success, or going all along, did you feel a little more competent?
The end result was definitely a success. I think I felt – I wouldn't say I was confident. I think I was probably even less confident than usual, because I could tell that if I did it right, it would be something I would really enjoy. And so I wanted to do it right the whole time. So I put it off for a while. But then finally, when I set out to do it, I wanted to do everything in the best way that I could. So I actually went to an Indian spice shop to buy the curry and the garam masala. and just walking in.
Was that the first time you'd ever been into it?
Yes.
Oh, my gosh.
It smelled so good. It smelled great. I love Indian food, but I've never been to an Indian spice shop. And, you know, plus they're making some food in the back. But just the smell of the spices in front was fantastic. I just sort of walked around and seeing all the little bottles. That was fun just by itself.
I'm so glad.
Yeah.
But like opened up a whole new culinary world for you.
And I said to the lady, I said, I'm making chicken curry. Which is the best of the curry? And she said, they're all good. You know?
Yeah. And, you know, unless you're going to do it yourself, which curry powder really is just a mixture of all of these different spices. So unless you're going to do it yourself, it's nice to have a prepared curry as a backup.
Yeah, exactly. That may be down the road.
So what'd you get? What I suggested? Bolsts?
They didn't have that one, actually. I got an Indian brand. I can't remember the name, but it was good.
Great.
It was great.
What kind of protein did you use? I think I told you to use chicken thighs.
Use chicken thighs. You know, rip the skin off of those puppies. And that worked really well. The other real pleasure in the cooking of it was when we mixed together in the food processor. That was also exciting, not having to go through the humiliation of having to slice anything. I used the food processor and, you know, put the onion and the ginger and the garlic in there.
The cilantro.
And the cilantro smelled fantastic.
I know. And let me tell you, that's like the secret ingredient. You can add that to anything and it makes it delicious.
My wife and I just took turns putting our face down in the food processor and smelling it. It was so good.
And so you sautéed that up.
We sautéed that. And then we came to, I think probably the only thing that was even close to a challenge was the deglazing after I cooked the chicken.
If you're not used to making curry, it feels very anti-intuitive to take all these spices and throw them into a pan and sauté them.
Yeah.
Because you feel like it's sticking.
Right.
Which is what it's supposed to do.
Right.
For those of you who don't know, deglazing is the act of adding something liquid or moist to a pan that has a lot of protein bits stuck on it. And so the condensation, the moisture of either liquid or moist ingredients, like an onion, will take all the stuff that's stuck to the bottom of the pan, or the fond, as it's called in French, up and allow it to go into whatever it is you're making, because that's got tons of flavor.
It was a little strange when I put the spices into the pan and started cooking that, because I wasn't exactly sure what it was supposed to look like, and it does look a little bit alarming when you first put it in. It was because it's supposed to be sort of pasty.
Yeah. And to me, what's sort of magical about it is it's pasty, which, you know, if you ever make gravy with flour, it sort of is what's going to thicken your sauce. And instead of using flour, it's just being thickened by the quantity of all these powdered spices. But then also you're getting the toastiness. And the minute it hits the pan, you all of a sudden start smelling all these flavors,
oh,
right?
Oh, yeah. It smelled fantastic.
Yeah, it's really the fun whole to do this.
This whole project was one smell sensation after another. I put the chicken back in, and the one thing that was really nice was, you know, I wasn't afraid that it kind of burned a little bit. And you had even said that I didn't have to worry about actually cooking it through. So anytime you tell me I don't have to worry about anything, that's always nice.
And then you added some liquid.
We just added some tomato sauce, and then we let that whole thing cook. And I added also some carrots and potatoes. And all cook that together. And that's really like my favorite kind of way to cook also, because just then you just add, everything's in there. It's bubbling away. It smells delicious. You can cover it. And then since I'm so obsessive compulsive, I can start cleaning while that's cooking, which is always satisfying to me because I can never enjoy a meal quite as much when I know that there's a whole bunch of dirty dishes in the next room.
God, what a great husband to have.
Well, that's my one job. When I'm not cooking, that's my one job usually is to do the dishes.
And so did you serve it with rice?
Yeah, we served it with rice.
What did Tess think? Tess, your little girl.
Well, you know, Tess, you know, anytime there's any spice anywhere near it, she's not going to touch it. So she smelled the food processor. She liked that okay, but she was a little suspicious overall. But we're not going to worry about Tess right now. We're going to wait till her palate develops a little.
Well, I'm glad you had a good experience.
Yeah.
How wonderful. Yeah. And I look forward to us picking up our classes once again.
Sure. And my wife thanks you as well that now I can cook a little bit.
I really encourage any of you who haven't already seen them to go onto our blog, which you can find at kcrw.com/goodfood, and take a look at the hysterical videos that Bob and his wife Tina did of this whole cooking saga. They're quite funny. So that was Bob Carlson. Bob is production director for KCRW. We've been talking about his massively successful chicken curry experience. You can also go to the Good Food blog and post your adventures cooking the same dish. We'd really love to hear from you there. You can find the blog at kcrw.com/goodfood. As I'm trying to show Bob, cooking can be a salvation. At the Village Kitchen near downtown LA, this restaurant is part of a journey from homelessness to employability. Meet someone in this unique culinary arts program from the newly opened Village Kitchen. That's next on KCRW and kcrw.com on Good Food. Homelessness and hopelessness often go hand in hand on the mean streets of Los Angeles, so it's extraordinary to hear of a program that's using a working kitchen to help women out of homelessness and into steady employment. Sue Campoy is the owner of Julianne in San Marino. She's also on the board of Good Shepherd Center and has been a central player in creating the Village Kitchen. Welcome.
Thank you.
So how did the idea for the Village Kitchen begin?
I went through a very difficult time in my life years ago and experienced financial insecurity in going through a divorce. And I was had a passion for cooking, and I'd entertained a lot during this period of my life. And I was fortunate to have the support of friends who started calling me to cook for them and to cater their parties. This gradually became a career, and then it led to my opening up Julianne in 1985, and we've been there now for 23 years. But in going through this process, I thought many times about the plight of a homeless woman and what is the difference? How do some people keep from going on the street? I became involved with Good Shepherd about 8 years ago, and when they were talking about doing phase three of the center, there was about 1,000 square feet left over that they weren't sure what to do with out of 40,000 square feet, and they were going to have 22 units for the women to live in. And I suggested starting a kitchen to teach them culinary skills. And so everybody agreed to that, and I never really thought it would happen. But we have a very persistent and wonderful board that in this course of 7 years was able to raise about $14 million. And the kitchen became a reality.
Wow. And so it's taken 7 years to bring it to fruition.
Right.
Tell me about the first time you saw it fully operational.
I was asked to design the kitchen a couple of years ago, and I had never done anything like that. But I just designed it based on what I had in my own business and what I wish I had. So when I saw the kitchen for the first time, it was really a wonderful experience. But a very emotional experience occurred for me when I saw them all dressed in their chef's coats and hats and preparing these red velvet cupcakes and their cinnamon rolls, and so proud to be employed in the kitchen. And it was just a wonderful experience. It was a culmination of a dream for me to be able to help these women. And I don't think there's any greater gratification you can get in life other than giving back to somebody who happens to be less fortunate than you.
Now, why do you think that this particular program, the Village Kitchen, is going to be successful? What kind of skills are you giving the employees?
Well, they have been training at Trade Tech, LA Trade Tech. So they've learned culinary skills. They've learned sanitation. We're teaching them how to make cappuccinos. We're teaching them sandwiches, pastry items, soups. And they'll be working there for 6 months, and then they go on.
Before they come to the Village Kitchen, they first have to complete a basic culinary arts education.
Right.
And Billie Jean, what part of the Good Shepherd program are you in now?
I'm in the Good Shepherd Transitional Women's Shelter, and I am also one of the chefs at the Village Kitchen restaurant.
How exciting. And you brought in this enormous box for me, which I just opened right before you came into the studio, and it is filled with, just beautiful things. Tell me what you've baked for me.
What I brought in today was our red velvet cupcakes with the cream cheese topping. And I would like to send a hello to Kathy. She was one of the chefs. She's a pastry chef. She volunteered to come in and give us that recipe and show us how to make the cupcakes that I'm presenting to you today.
For those of us who decide to make the trip down to the Village Kitchen and eat a little something, what do you recommend that we try?
We have a homemade biscuit breakfast sandwich with egg and bacon. That's a very good. If you want to come for lunch, we have a wonderful roast beef, and we have a Cobb salad, which is lemon grilled chicken, and we have a wonderful Greek salad.
Exciting. Well, we'll definitely have a link for everybody who listens so they can take a look at where the kitchen is and come down and support everybody. The Village Kitchen is part of the Good Shepherd Center on Beverly Boulevard near downtown. I was speaking with Good Shepherd board member Sue Campoy and resident Billie Jean Daniels, who's part of the Culinary Arts Program at the Kitchen. Read more about the Village Kitchen and homelessness in L.A. at kcrw.com/goodfood. Winemaking, well, it's as old as human existence, but today's fine wines can be made in very controlled settings to ensure consistent outcomes. My next guest wants us to return to the, quote, authentic winemaking, and she has a thing or two for that guy Robert Parker and his wine criticism. I'll be right back with a wine radical next on Good Food. You're listening to KCRW and KCRW.com. Well, Los Angeles now has a wine writer for the Sunday LA Times magazine. Alice Feiring, James Beard award-winning wine blogger and journalist who contributes often to the New York Times. She also has a new book, The Battle for Wine and Love, or How I Saved the World from Parkerization. And I have to say that she has taken this opportunity with a huge splash with her LA Times article about the limitations, shall we say, of California wine. So, boy, you have created some waves. So let's talk about the problems that you have with California wine.
I do want to say that it didn't always used to be this way. In fact, I used to drink a lot of California wines. And what happened as the grapes got riper and riper and started being sweeter and sweeter and thus having to be more and more manipulated, I got less and less interested.
You talk about ripeness and then you talk about manipulation, which leads me to suspect that this was not always the way it was done.
Well, traditionally, you would pick while the grape was in balance, so you didn't have to necessarily adjust for acidity. And basically, you would have structure, and wine is about structure, the tannin, acid, fruit balance, and when you grow just for ripeness, you only have fruit.
So this is interesting, because when you say the word structure, the structure is the balance of the wine. And when the grapes are allowed to become too ripe, then the wine goes out of balance, and then you have to make up for that somewhere in the process.
Exactly.
What are people doing?
Either acidification, adding in bags of tartaric acid so you can get, you know, like squeezing the lemon on a piece of fish. They are taking out the alcohol for reverse osmosis.
Now, how do they do that? This is so odd to me that they would create all this alcohol and then have to take it away.
I know. It's kind of odd, isn't it? Well, the fact of the matter is, well, 14%, anything over 14% alcohol is taxed extra. So there's a financial incentive to take it down. And also somebody like Clark Smith, who runs the biggest operation of reverse osmosis in the New World, or at least maybe I should just say California, would say he likes to adjust the wine to its sweet spot. So he separates the wine into sludge, alcohol, and water, and then reconstitutes it back to where he thinks is perfect. It's like digitizing.
So a winemaker takes their wine and they bring it to him, and he manipulates it in this way.
Mm-hmm. Now, of course, not everybody, but it is rampant.
Wow. And how long has that been going on?
I don't know, ever since they started making de-alcoholized wine, probably in the 70s.
Oh, that's interesting. So they used to use this process originally so that people who can't drink alcohol could enjoy the flavor of wine.
Exactly.
Wow.
Exactly.
Fascinating. So then your problem with California wine is that it's become this highly technical juggernaut of overripe grapes?
Well, juggernaut of overripe grapes and then putting things in like oak product for flavoring, tannin addition. They take the tannin out of the grape and then they put it back in with either chestnut or wood tannins, which is crazy to me.
They'll take the tannins out of the juice.
Yeah.
Right. And then they'll add it back in using a tannin that isn't a grape tannin.
Exactly.
Hmm. So would one call you a purist or someone who strives for the authentic?
I've been called a purist before, and I've been called worse.
So talk to me then about authenticity.
The wines that I enjoy the most are wines... Well, from what region? Right now, I'm drinking a lot of wines from the Loire, and why I like them so much, I like wines that are made with their own yeast, that they don't have added yeast to affect the fermentation. I find they're way more complex, and they really reflect the vintage and the place that they come from. So I like wines that are organically or biodynamically farmed, but basically with an absence of chemical, no matter how you get to it. And picked, you know, when they're ripe, not super ripe. I joke, I say I have a very narrow palate. I just basically like my wine natural. If I can't tell where wine comes from, I kind of get suspicious.
Do you think that most consumers of wine understand that the wine has been so manipulated?
No, I believe most people don't know. And for some people, it wouldn't make a difference. But there's a lot invested in telling the public that wine is made in the vineyard and not in the winery, when just the opposite is true. So it's kind of a message that the industry doesn't want out and could be very threatened by.
Do you think that the ratings, and in particular the very, very famous Parker 100-point rating system, has had an effect on creating the desire for a certain type of wine?
Very definitely. So much of the wine world is based on trying to manufacture a wine that suits Parker palate, which actually might be as narrow as mine, just on different side of the coin. He does award great points to very large, fleshy, oaky, vanilla, toasty-driven wines. And there's a lot of technology to help make a wine taste like that.
I can't allow you to leave without you at least throwing us a crumb. Give us a couple of California wines that you do love.
Absolutely. They do exist. There are some very brave people in the world making wine, as they always have. So Steve Edmonds of Edmonds St. John, love his wines, and they age up beautifully. Kathy Corazon, out of my price point, Napa Cabernetist, she makes beautiful Cabernet.
The Battle for Wine and Love, or How I Saved the World from Parkerization, is Alice Fearing's book. She's also the newly appointed wine writer for the LA Times Sunday magazine. You can find info on today's show, watch the latest Good Food video, download this show and past episodes online at kcrw.com/goodfood. Please write me at goodfood@kcrw.com. I'll write back. Check out the Good Food blog there, too. Good Food's executive producer is Jennifer Farrow. The show is produced by Thea Challoner with Bob Carlson, Candace Moyer, Connie Alvarez, and Holly Carson. The music supervisor is Gary Messiha. Special thanks to Karen Soriano and Ronnie Mickelson. I'm Evan Kleiman. Tune in next week for another edition of Good Food.